Edition of Troy Noons is an absolute podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy 2-0 start to the season we all really, really care about. There's nothing else that's happening in Syracuse sports.
Nope, not a sport. In all seriousness, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, the Syracuse Orange football team does have two more games. Dan, your at least initial thoughts on the Clemson game. I know, obviously, it was great to see us really fighting into the fourth quarter with the number one team in the nation. But does this do more harm than good?
I don't think it does more harm than good. I just think it's pretty much a net neutral result. I don't think when you're 3-6, dropping a game ever is all that helpful. I guess I'd rather lose by 10 points and look really game to play a good Clemson team, but it still raises the questions about, you know, why couldn't this team bring the same effort against USF or even look this competent in Florida State, and obviously the Louisville game was a disaster. So obviously you want to take away some positive things from a 10-point loss, which honestly was just that close, if not a little closer, considering Syracuse outscored Clemson through the last like 58 minutes of the game. But it almost like makes me more annoyed about how the previous six games worked out.
Yeah, I mean, and we said the same after LSU, like, you know, wow, great for us, like really putting in you know, a solid effort against a great team. Problem is, you know, you need to kind of follow through. And not just have a great effort, but actually win the game. I mean, USF's turned things around. That's one thing. Louisville's going to be bowl bound. That's another. But then, you know, you look at the Virginia game. I mean, Pitt's a good team, but winnable games that aren't won at some point need to count against you. And this isn't a call for Schaefer's head. This is more of just an overall point that you can only have so many moral victories until they're just losses.
Yeah, and, you know, we've already seen this exact game with the LSU. I mean, it was the same difference. It was almost exactly the same score. Obviously, 3 points extra for each team. But like you said, we played Clemson close last year. We played Florida State close last year. It's just really frustrating that this team seems to be able to hang with good teams like this on occasion but won't break through, and then doesn't, you know, they don't let those performances translate when the stakes maybe seem slightly lower or against teams that they should be competitive with. So I'd love to be taking moral victory away from this, and I think you still can to a certain extent, but at some point it's going to ring hollow when the results just aren't there in the other games. And we saw the same thing last year. I mean, we could have beaten Clemson at Death Valley, and, you know, that was fun to think about, but when you're going 3-9, I mean, you can only take so much away from the two games against top 10 opponents that are ultimately, you know, they're two of the nine losses. They're not, you know, leading to better things.
Right. And I think that's what everyone needs to keep in mind on both sides of the argument with regard to Scott Schaefer's tenure, is that everything that happens needs to lead to something. And no, it's not always going to show in the win-loss record, but, you know, it needs to lead to something. It needs to lead to something that you can start to be able to touch and see, even if it's, you know, minimal. I mean, I would say, like, case in point, you know, Doug Marrone's first year, no, 4-8 didn't seem like leaps and bounds forward just on a wins-loss standpoint, but if you looked at the team, if you looked at how competitive they were, if you looked at how competent they were in offense, the fact that they were competitive in most games with, you know, a former point guard at quarterback, all these things, to see a team that was 4-8 and really wasn't that far away from 6-6, I think gave us hope for the future. This year, I'm not going to say that there's no hope for the future, because I very much think there is, and I think, you know, we're a couple bad bounces away from, you know, 1-9, just like we're a couple good bounces away from 5-5 or so. But yeah, I think that if we lose out here, it's going to be very tough to get those same kind of, you know, warm fuzzies that we felt at the end of the first year of the Marrone era, and now You know, this isn't the first year of Schaefer either. This is year three, and it's kind of weird to me to hear anyone kind of talking about full rebuild when that never should have been the case.
Yeah, there are a lot of really false equivalencies being made by, you know, people who are very gung-ho about keeping Schaefer, and obviously there's still games to be played, and the NC State and BC games very much do matter for him, even if we can't make a bowl, or in like 99% chance we won't make a bowl based on the 5-7 stuff that's going on. But like, people have been making the Coach Mack comparison, which obviously Coach Mack followed Maloney, who was G-Rob, not quite as bad as G-Rob, but similar effect on the program, and it took Coach Mack a while, but we're just also not living in the 1970s and 1980s where coaches get 5-6 years. It's a much quicker turnaround. People, there are more games. There's more information available and more information to glean. There's more teams. The whole college football world has changed. So you can't compare what Schaefer is doing now to what Coach Mack did then for just a whole host of reasons. So I don't know. I think there are valid points to be made in his favor in terms of staying patient and seeing through the process. I just think that the Coach Mack comparison and then the Dave Cutcliffe comparison that we see all the time, like, the situations are so much different. Duke had been bad for pretty much since Spurrier left, and that was a quick, you know, blip in the radar for Duke's entire program. Like, they've been bad for pretty much the entirety of the history of the program, and it took Cutcliffe a while, but Cutcliffe also had been a head coach before. He had gotten kind of a raw deal. He had obviously been the tutor to the Manning brothers, so he had a lot more going for him too, and Duke had reason to be patient because they had never been good. It wasn't like there was something to fall back on just 4 years before, like where Schaefer, you know, was following Marone, who, you know, people, for whatever reason, Marone's still this super hot-button topic around Syracuse fans, but he was quite successful, especially considering where he was coming from following Greg Robinson. So I just think those two comparisons are really, they don't ring true when you actually look at the context of where Coach Mack and where Dave Cutcliffe are coming for their respective jobs. And it's a bit tiring to see those be all that when there are far better examples to use in terms of what Schaefer or why Schaefer deserves to stick around for another year plus.
Yeah, I think that's what's most frustrating to me, and I think we saw it a lot in the comments today, I think all week. There aren't a lot of people vehemently fighting to fire Schaefer, you know, and I would include myself in that. Like, I'm not vehemently, you know, fighting for it, and if he wins the next two games, it's going to be very hard for me to just to say with 100% certainty that he should leave. I just think the folks that are defending him are just doing such a lazy, hackneyed job of it, and you're hearing, and this is, I don't want to turn this into an attacking people who defend Schaefer. You can defend Schaefer all you want. I just think if you're going to defend someone, make sure that you have, you know, cogent and tangible points together. And I just don't think, you know, it's the stuff about Cutcliffe. You hear it from the fan base, and then suddenly, you know, Schaefer's parroting it, and vice versa. Schaefer says the team's young, deal with a lot of injuries. Every one of his defenders seems to say the same things. Like, you can't lean on those things forever. And like you said, the Cutcliffe the comparison's a joke. McPherson, despite the fact that he struggled to make a bowl game for a few years, he still was going like 5-6. So it you know, it's not as if he was bottoming out. He was still fielding a competitive team. There are defensible points for Schaefer, and I think that, you know, that's getting lost in the shuffle and in this conversation, because those defending him just aren't doing a good job of portraying why he should stay. The good guy crap, that trope's a joke. Every guy's a good guy until he's a bad guy. That's just how it works. I think that if you wanted to defend Schaefer, there's some easy things to latch on to. The competitiveness against LSU and excuse me, Clemson are, you know, some of those things. The progress of certain offensive skill players are another, but I wouldn't latch on to the progress of the offense. I would stay as far away as I could from the defense. You could talk about youth, but only if you've been talking about it all season. You know, there are defense points there, and I think that, you know, one of the bigger ones that I give some credence to is the, like, well, you know, this is, we know how things are right now, and maybe it's worth rolling the dice on one more year of this versus what could be a potential teardown. And I think that, you know, there is some weight to that. But you look at all these other programs that have really kind of stopped on a dime and changed things very quickly. And I just, it's getting harder and harder to buy that logic that you know, why not SU? Temple can do it. Memphis can do it. Houston, obviously, is able to go from 500 to a potential undefeated team. But there's a lot of, you know, programs around the country that are able to win six games with a lot of regularity in a lot more dire straits than we are financially, in a lot weirder geographies than we are. It's getting harder and harder to believe that SU, with at least a competent coach, you know, can't win six games every year.
Yeah, and it's interesting because a lot of the defense has been that he has built this really strong, young roster. I think now might even, you could argue that it would even be a better time to make a move like that, because instead of rebuilding from you know, the start, and obviously, you know, there are things to take into consideration with system and whatnot, but the roster isn't totally gutted like it was, even when, I know people argue that Robinson recruited better than Marone and Schaefer, but when Marone took over, there were a lot of players who he determined, just for either personality-wise or ability-wise, were just not cut out to play for his program. So some of it's on him, but basically we had major depth issues for almost his entire tenure here based on the great cutting of many players. I mean, for lack of a better term, he basically cut them, which isn't, you know, the prettiest thing to say about college sports, but it is a reality up until we get four-year guaranteed scholarships. But Schaefer has left, you know, there isn't a ton of depth as we've seen with some of the injuries, but there is a lot of talent, and you can make the argument that if you bring in a coach who is more proven, who has shown that he can lead a football team, who's been a head coach before, he's inheriting a pretty good situation rather than a total rebuild. And while some coaches might like the idea of rebuilding a program in their image, I'm sure there are others who would look at the Syracuse team and say, hey, these guys are not that far away. There's some good talent. They've won with Clemson 2 years in a row, and Clemson's going to be a playoff team. Obviously, they're not ready to make that kind of jump, but it could be an idea for some coaches where, hey, these guys are not that far away. This is a better situation than what Syracuse looks like on paper as a private school in New York. There's some real talent here. So Schaefer deserves some credit for that, but I think you need to look and see, is Schaefer the best possible coach available? I've seen people, I forget who it was, or if it was on our site or elsewhere, but someone said, you know, Coyle should look at it as Schaefer is a candidate for the job next year. What, is there someone else you would hire ahead of him, or is he the guy you would tap? And I don't know if it's quite that, I don't know if that's quite a fair thing to say, but it does make it interesting. Like, is Schaefer the best guy that you could possibly get as Syracuse going into this market, which admittedly is pretty flooded? It's hard to defend when there are so many games that have been left on the table the last couple of years. So I respect whatever they choose to do. I know it's not an easy decision, and it's not an obvious one like it was with Robinson, who was definitely given a year too many. But I don't think you can just automatically say, based on what we've seen, that he is definitely the best coach available for this team heading into 2016.
No, I agree, and you know what? I mean, there was a really, really comprehensive list on the site, and it's one we're probably going to call it all up a lot in the coming weeks, no matter what happens. I think Nola Hughes put that together, and it was upwards of 25 folks, all of whom, you know, are reachable by some measure. Obviously, you know, some more than others, but you know, there's definitely candidates out there. I think brought up a lot of great points. I'm going to try to keep it as concise as possible. With regard to the recruiting and personnel stuff in particular, you know, I've said this about recruiting for a long time, and it just seems like it goes in one ear and out the other. And I'm not the only one who says it either, but it goes in one ear and out the other with a lot of fans of, you know, you can recruit well all you want, but a bad coach can turn, you know, good and great recruits into good and bad recruits, and a great coach can turn good recruits into great recruits. You know, recruiting is important, of course, and you should get talent in the door, but what you do with that talent is far more important. And I know Sean said this today, and some people seem to try to refute him on the site. But it is true. You know, you look at all these 4-star kids that we've had on the books, and they haven't been brought in. You look at all these, you know, well-regarded 3-stars that haven't worked out, and not just us, or anyone. You know, at the end of the day, no one cares how many 4 and 5 stars you had if you didn't do anything with them. And I think that's, you know, in some ways why, you know, a guy like Les Miles, who's recruited so well and had so much NFL talent on his roster, you know, he's at this point, I don't agree that he should be on the hot seat, but, you know, he's 4 years removed from a title, and at least. And, you know, with all that NFL talent, he's gone too long without winning it. Obviously, he has to contend with Alabama every year, which has just as much NFL talent. But point is that, you know, good coaching can do a lot with recruits, regardless of their talent level. The weird thing is, though, you know, we have depth issues now. We had depth issues when Marone arrived. Why do we have depth issues now? Excuse me. Given that, you know, it wasn't a teardown rebuild. There were pieces in place and pieces that got Syracuse to a bowl in Schaefer's first season. All of that's true. So it seems weird to me now that we have all these depth issues and, you know, we have to throw in, you know, walk-ons at quarterback and we have to see red shirts burned unnecessarily. I would also mention that, you know, Marone really coached up kids that star-wise were not there. I mean, Chandler Jones being the shining example there, along with Ryan Nassib and others. But one of the other coaches on that staff was Scott Schaefer. And that, to me, I think the most perplexing part is did Schaefer have little to do with it then, or did he hire the wrong guys under him now and he's not able to coach them up the same way he did as a positional coach or, you know, as a coordinator?
The depth thing is interesting. I've been trying to figure out the answer, and I'm actually looking now. I don't remember how many guys we brought in that first Schaefer turnaround, but it definitely wasn't like when Marone took over and we had a recruiting class of 13. I think it was pretty close to a full class. So the numbers should be there. Obviously, there have been injuries, especially last year, this year to a slightly lesser extent, more than the average team suffers. Last year was ridiculous. This year, obviously, the quarterbacks are easy to point to, but overall, I think it's fairly normal, maybe slightly above what a normal team goes through. It just seems to be focused on a lot of the same position. But we have a lot of guys who are leaving the program. We have the disqualifications, which is, you know, you only think of it as like a couple of player here and there, but it's been like 4 or 5 guys, all of whom pretty much were expected to make some kind of impact. You have the risks, like Marcus Blair, who I'm fine with Syracuse taking risks on kids who are questionable qualifiers. I think maybe doing it too much might not be the best thing. But I think to try to overcome the talent deficit that you face with other teams, I think it's worthwhile. But it seems like far too often it bites Syracuse rather than getting the player through. So it's tough to really know why these depth issues continue to plague the program. It was very easy to point to it with Marone. And I guess 2013, I'm looking now, it was 19 kids, so a couple of whom didn't make it. So I guess that probably didn't help. That's not close to a full class, but it is a bit strange, and I don't know that all of the blame should be put on the coaches, but it is kind of an interesting confluence of things that have hurt the team in terms of being able to withstand injuries and withstand, you know, players not panning out.
No, and I hear that, and I think, you know, and you know, this isn't to point a bunch of fingers, just more to point out an oddity, I guess, with the way SU does things. But, you know, I think those questions are going to be louder, maybe clearer as the weeks go on. Looking at the NC State game a little bit, Dan, are you assuming that Zach Mahoney is going to be under center in this game? I think we're hoping he is. I think we're assuming that Eric Dungy is dealing with a concussion or something similar. So do you think Mahoney's the quarterback? And I guess even if he isn't, do you hope that the decision ends up being that he should be?
Yeah, I think unless Dungy is like 100% healthy with no... I mean, if it's not a concussion, then there's a lot less risk for him to suffer another one right away. But I just think it makes the most sense to let Mahoney go out there. He's played quite well. I mean, the numbers don't quite bear it out, but considering, you know, the offense being a lot different and how he's being asked to move the ball, I think he's been pretty game against two really tough opponents. I think for whatever reason, and you watched the games twice, so you probably have a better sense of it, but it almost feels like kind of paring down the playbook and shifting to this option attack has almost made Lester a bit more effective as a play caller for Mahoney. He seems to not try as many things that might not work. He kind of seems to go and limit the play calling and just allow him to do the things he's good at, and I think that's probably helped. But overall, I just don't think if Dungy is the quarterback of the future, which I very much think he is, I just don't think it's worth risking further injury if he's not like 1,000% healthy.
Agreed. And, you know, you brought up a good point there, too, with the offense. People keep wondering, you know, why does the offense look more fluid? You know, why does it look better with Mahoney out there? And yeah, the answer is exactly what you said. And the announcers brought it up, too. It's that it's a simplified playbook. Everything's really kind of, for the most part, run out of that split back set, and what they do is the same thing that they were doing really successfully earlier in the year against easier opponents, which is, you know, you have split backs, you set a guy in motion, and everything is pretty much run out of the same formation, and it really just it is a pure option play. I feel like for a while Dungy was doing that, but then that turned into a lot of him taking off very quickly. A lot of him taking hits unnecessarily. I mean, Mahoney, I love Dungy. I think that he's a great playmaker, and I really, you know, love the energy he's brought to the program. But I think right now Mahoney's a smarter runner and knows better how to protect himself. I think they're about the same speed-wise, but it did seem like Mahoney just had more, you know, land and space in front of him. Odd, especially for someone who can't really throw the ball. But in general, yeah, I think that it was an easy offense. They maybe had two or three formations max they came out of. But you had, you know, 5 to 7 plays minimum coming out of the same formation. And then you obviously switch out personnel. You give different looks on the routes. There was a lot there that I really, really liked. Clemson sniffed out some of it, but didn't sniff out a ton of it. And you know what, against the worst team, and you hadn't, this is when you start racking your brain about all these games that we struggled offensively and lost. If you run an offense like that, excuse me, this is the type of thing that, you know, could have turned into more this year and is probably going to be ammo for, you know, any talk of bringing everybody back next year is like, well, you know, if you run this offense with these players, these are the results you're going to get. So yeah, I liked what I saw. And I think we'll probably, especially if Mahoney's out there, and I think he will be, I think we're going to see more of it against NC State. And I'm curious to see how a defense that isn't as, you know, quick and isn't as deep as Clemson's, how they read and react to that.
Yeah, and I also think it helps that, surprisingly, I mean, I know he's not like a refined passer, but Mahoney's hasn't been playing quarterback that long in his career, college or otherwise, and he's just really, really good with the option. I mean, there were only maybe one or two plays where he didn't make the correct read, I don't think. And obviously he maybe got totally flooded and there was no real great read, but I think Dungy's way more effective when he's kind of improvising and rolling out and scrambling. I don't think he's a great option quarterback, at least not yet. Mahoney's a fantastic option quarterback, and that's really his one above, you know, plus skill, I think. His arm is a very much a work in progress, but he does that one thing really well. And the fact that Clemson, it's not like Clemson never sees the option. I mean, they played they played Georgia Tech, which is a different type of option attack.
Yeah, they play Georgia Tech every year.
Yeah, And that's not the same option that we were running, but, you know, same principles apply. And I'm sure they play at least one or two other teams that use the option at least a little bit, and they just could not. Even when they stopped it once, I mean, there was no... You could never quite tell if they were just going to shut it down or he was going to break like a nice 12-yard run. So definitely impressive. I don't know how sustainable it is. I don't know. We'll find out a lot at this NC State game because they'll have two full games pretty much to watch of the team kind of running and seeing how effective it is. But it's definitely interesting and something to think about, although I do think Dungy is probably the future of that position just because I think he has the more polished and varied skill set.
Yeah, I do agree. You know, I like Mahoney a lot, especially given the positions he's been put in. I think that he's done a lot with very little. I do think if Dungy, you know, his career gets cut short because of injury, and hopefully not, I do think a scholarship player is going to have to come in there, you know, and take over that job, no matter what point it is. But, you know, Mahoney has done a lot of things right, and I know we talked about it internally, we talked about it in the comments section. You look at some of the reads that Mahoney made. I mean, it's not that he made terrible reads on passes. He actually made really good ones for the most part. It was just he just couldn't put the ball where it was supposed to be. Almost reminded me a little bit of what, you know, Peyton Manning was going through before he was removed from Broncos game on Sunday, is that, you know, Mahoney just doesn't have the arm strength and the precision to get the ball there, but he was, by and large, pretty close on a lot of them. And I guess my only question is, if Dungy could run the option in a similar way, would he still have the same looks out there? Because if he could, you know, he'd run for 150 and throw for 300 a game. I mean, everything was wide open. And again, that might be because Clemson was definitely cheating toward the run, knowing that Mahoney couldn't throw. But you definitely saw something there, and something that I don't think can just be explained away by a certain quarterback's strength or weakness. You know, this is an offense, and I don't want to give Lester so much credit as to call him, you know, anything more than a competent offense coordinator right now. But there are some moments where he draws up a play that really, really works, and he has an offense that right now 40% of the time is really, really effective. Now he needs to find a way to get that, you know, up above, you know, 50, 60, and then we start talking extension and everything else.
Yeah, and I will say, if Schaefer comes back, this might be counterintuitive because the greater offensive numbers are pretty bad, although I think a lot of that is related to the defense not being able to drop the field. I think they would look better with a competent defense, which we've pretty much had every other year under Schaefer. The defense has been at least okay. I'd be interested to see how Lester come back. I don't think we would... I think if Schaefer comes back, I think pretty much the whole staff is coming back, and you're just going with that. I don't think you need to mandate a new coordinator at either spot. We going back to the depth thing, just because I was doing a head count while we were talking there, that 2013 class, the first Schaefer class after Marone left, we had 23 kids, including like a guy like Alaric Perry, who was more of a walk-on, but 23 guys counted on, I think, Scout is where I was looking. Only 14 are still on the roster, and only a handful of those guys are like legitimate factors in the team, so... I think that's probably where you can point to the depth issues. That class really did not pan out.
Yeah, and I know that there's a lot of other caveats to that class, too. You know, you had a late scramble. I think we'd lost more than 50% of the class after Marone left. The only thing that kept a bunch of guys around was the fact that, you know, Schaefer had been there before. So it was at least some continuity. But, again, that gets back to my point and a lot of other people's point. If you're continuity higher, you really need to be able to do more. I will say that you're right. If Schaefer comes back, I don't think it needs to be a wholesale change. That said, you know, wouldn't be. It's not that I wouldn't be crying. Like, Chuck Bulla is a good defensive coordinator. I think last year he would have probably gotten more interest for a bigger defensive coordinator job. This year, I'm not so sure, but you never know. I think one of, you know, Doust, Lee, or Bulla seems likely to leave on their own accord, especially if they don't really like where things are going or don't feel optimistic about where things are going. I think Leicester could stick around, probably will stick around unless Schaefer's forced to make a change. And then that could be something that we really haven't discussed of, like, if Schaefer comes back, is he brought back with, you know, the mandate from Mark Coyle of, here are candidates that I've vetted out already. Like, tell me who you could potentially see on your staff. And you know, these will be guys with NFL experience or Power 5 experience, or at least, you know, MAC level experience as coordinators, et cetera. I think the one guy I might need to go, and I'm not in the business of calling for people's jobs unless it's something really egregious. Hi, George McDonald. But other than that, I think Fred Reed has worn out his welcome. I just think the secondary, you know, the defense did a really nice job in the last three quarters probably of the Clemson game this past week. But beyond that, I really have been sorely disappointed by everything I've seen from the secondary. And before these young kids get any worse or pick up any more bad habits, because there's a lot of talent there and a lot of upside, I think it's time to let him go. I just don't think you can have no changes on a staff for two straight years after two straight 3-9 seasons.
Yeah, I'm more meant the coordinators. Fred Reed, like we've talked about it, even in the Clemson game, like there were plays where the guys just, they never look back for the ball. They never like make a play on the ball in the air. It's just unlike anything you see taught if you've ever like been around a defensive back practice at any competent level. So I agree there. I just think if you're going forward with Schaefer, I think you want to allow the systems to progress. And obviously the defense has been awful this year. You clearly can't sugarcoat it. But I trust after watching 2013 was a pretty good defensive team outside of the Georgia Tech game. Florida State and Clemson were just ridiculous that year, so I don't count that too much. But then last year's defense was awesome. It just didn't get any help from the offense. And then, obviously, Schaefer's 4 years as DC were all between above average and very good. So I trust that there will be a rebound there next year. Offensively, I kind of want to see what Leicester can do with the ball in his hands more than he's had this year, because the defense gives up so many big drives. And with a full offseason of knowing his starting quarterback is going to be back and understanding the playmakers. So, I don't know. I think that it's almost a tough position to put Schaefer in, to give him 1 year, even if you'd probably resign him, as we've talked about, like you can't make him a lame duck. But if you give him a 1 year extension, but then say he has to replace the offensive system, then you know, there's a chance someone steps in and succeeds right away, but there's a chance that it's not going to be any better because you're starting from square one and maybe the guy doesn't have the exact right pieces. So I think if you go forward with this coaching staff, I think you kind of, unless someone leaves, you have to kind of, see what this staff has next year, and if not, then it's probably wholesale from there.
Agree completely. I guess to close the book on football for this one, at least temporarily, what do you think happens on Saturday? Again, we're probably assuming that Mahoney's playing, and I'm going to assume Fredericks is out, but with those two things in mind, how do you see this going down in Raleigh?
I've just been bitten too many times with this team against comparable opponents. I am not a big NC State fan. We kind of rag on them all the time. I don't think they have a win over a winning team this year. But they play good teams hard just like we do, and they win the games they're supposed to. I think NC State will take this one by between 10 and 14 points.
Yeah, I've got the same. I know I'll have a Q&A going up with Back in the Pack, SB Nation's NC State site tomorrow/today for those listening. And I think I went 30-23. Sounded about right. I think that the option can do something against them, but at the same time, I think Brissett, we saw what he did to us at the beginning of last year's game, and I think that there's a lot of similar things he can do to us. I also think that Samuels, their tight end, is a very Tyler Boyd type who's going to do some unpleasant things to us, unfortunately.
Yeah, we'll see. It would be nice to get a win. There's no real advantage to losing. We don't get a higher draft pick, as people joke all the time. So, whether even if you're rooting, I mean, there are some people who, I think it's weird to blindly support Schaefer. I think it's just as weird to get so vehemently angry about the thought of him coaching again. that you're like if not rooting for the team to lose, like you're almost rooting for yourself to be right. So I think both of those are probably the wrong stance. So obviously I want the team to win. I would love for Schaefer to pick up two big wins and have some momentum going forward. That'd be great. So obviously, even if we're critical of the coaches, I think obviously you agree we would love for them to go and win the next two games by like 40 points each and then make this a very easy decision for everyone.
You bet. I know. I don't travel cross country once a year to see a team to watch them lose. So I definitely, I'll be at the game on Saturday, and I fully expect, well, not fully expect, I optimistically think that my streak of SU wins while I'm in attendance could continue, but we'll see. SU, don't let me down, please. But moving on to halftime, as per usual, Dan, what have you been drinking for the last week?
A lot of the standards. I've had some Brooklyn Lager, I've had some Goose, Goose Island, which is easy to find everywhere. Some different stuff from Captain Lawrence. The one that stands out that I haven't had before until last night, I had Stagmeyer Pumpkin Ale from the Lion Brewery. It's one of the more like understated, almost pale ale-y, quite, you know, nice flavor, but very drinkable, not too heavy. One of those kind of pumpkin beers, kind of like the Post Road Pumpkin Ale is. Definitely more a beer flavor with like kind of a hint of pumpkin, which I know a lot of people prefer. But definitely quite good. So I hadn't even seen this one before, but it was on tap last night where I was. So definitely recommend that one for a more moderate pumpkin beer selection versus like pumpkin, which is obviously very heavy, and a lot of those types.
Yeah, I am I'm looking forward to hopefully grabbing some my first and maybe only pumpkin of the year down North Carolina next week. And this weekend. But some things that I had once I felt better and was on antibiotics. Let's see. I was down at the brewery briefly. I had to pick up some beers that I'd ordered there. Had some interesting stuff from them. Had a Prairie Roux, which is a collaboration with Prairie Artisan Ales down in Tulsa. For those who are unfamiliar, really, really enjoyable beer. Super drinkable. If I hadn't been sick and was going to be around there a couple weekends, probably would have grabbed a growler fill. Ukulele, which is a chili beer that they had made. Really interesting, kind of a golden ale with some ghost pepper action on the back end. I'm not a big spicy beer fan, but it really really had a nice kick. Had myself a Thrill Seeker IPA from Beechwood that I picked up when I was down there. And then this afternoon, we were at the office and looking for some beverages and grabbed Stone had their Chocoveza, their kind of, you know, Mexican hot chocolate inspired milk stout. Some nice cinnamon, chili peppers, vanilla, nice nutmeg. They have them in six packs this year after having them in Bombers last year. Very, very good brew. For those who haven't seen it on the shelf, would highly recommend grabbing some.
Are you overly upset about the Ballast Point news, or are you going to assume we're going to be okay and still have pretty good grapefruit sculpting going forward?
See, I feel like the purchase, in this case, I mean, $1 billion, dude, go for it. Like, I don't give a shit. If you have anything worth $1 billion, and somebody's willing to buy it, and you can still be heavily involved and still have control over your own. Like, that's the thing. This isn't Coors or Miller or AB, and AB owns all of those now. You know, buying something. This is Constellation, which is, yes, they own like Modelo and Corona, but like, They don't really control the ingredients and the process the same way. This is more about distribution and getting Ballast Point, to be honest, into more bars and restaurants. And I think that's a good thing for everybody. I don't really think they're going to touch the ingredients. I don't know how much the price is going to change. If anything, it would go down, not up, because Ballast Point's pricing really can't go up much more than it already is at. But yeah, I think that this is the excuse me. This is the lesser of the evils that come out of purchases. And yeah, I'm optimistic that things are going to be just fine.
Yeah, I think their stuff is pretty I think most non-beer drinkers would probably appreciate it more than they would like the normal IPA, despite it being it's pretty hoppy. At least the Stolpins are, but they're not going to buy it to ruin it. So I agree, and I think even like the stuff with the InBev. Obviously, I haven't been 21, you know, for 10 years. I've been for drinking legally for like 4, and drinking like good stuff for about the same. But I don't know. I almost feel like it's almost like a boogeyman type thing where maybe there's some things are affected, but even with like Goose Island and some of the others, I haven't noticed like a giant drop off.
Yeah, I mean, the only one I've really noticed a drop off isn't even a macro takeover of craft. It's Green Flash's purchase of Alpine is the only thing that showed like a real marked difference to me, at least. I think the Elysian stuff tastes just the same as it did. The Golden Road stuff, I mean, it wouldn't be affected right now anyway, but hasn't really tasted different from the minimal amounts I've had since the purchase. But yeah, I think Green Flash has had a bit of a negative effect on Alpine, if only because Green Flash is one of a handful of breweries that just, you know, have like a signature hop profile and that you can always kind of, and a signature malt profile, you can always just, you just know it's that. Like, I mean, Rogue has this. I think New Belgium has it. Stone definitely does. Prairie does for sure. I just think that, like, when it comes to Green Flash as a very strong one, I think that bleeds through far too much in the Alpine beers, and it's changed the character of them of a bit too much for my liking.
Yeah, that's fair. I've only had the Alpine beers a couple times, so I wouldn't even have a good frame of reference for them.
Fair enough. All right, moving on to basketball. Basketball's 2-0. That's great. How we got there wasn't as great. Dan, biggest problem through two games, is it the amount of minutes we've had to log on our best players? Is it problems at the center position? Is it the fact that we really had to fight against two lesser opponents? What's your biggest red flag before we continue into some positive things?
I think it's everything concerning the post for us. I think it's very obvious Daywon Coleman is not all the way where we need him to be. Probably not even close, and Boeheim talked about that last night. And this team just does... If this team doesn't hit like a moderate amount of shots, it's going to get ugly. This team... obviously, Tyler Lydon did some nice things closer to the paint last night, down the stretch, and Roberson had a really strong night on the board, but he was really the only one, and then he fouled out. But this team definitely needs to find some kind of identity around the hoop. Otherwise, you know, we're just asking for teams to extend the defense way out and make us shoot better than, like, 35% from three. Otherwise, things to get really troublesome. So I think last night we rebounded well after a really, really shaky first like 27-28 minutes of the game, but it definitely kind of exposed what the issues are, and I don't think they were a major secret, but something is going to have to happen with the centers. Whether it's Coleman kind of getting back into the groove and finding himself, or Avoco becoming more of a factor. I think Lydon gave a valiant effort, but he clearly is not the guy. Like, he should not be playing the five more than a handful of minutes, and we had him there a lot last night. So if he has to play like 15 plus minutes at the five, we're going to be in some trouble this year.
You know, I think part of the issue too, and this isn't to, I mean, obviously not his fault, but, you know, last year's offense kind of just pivoted off of whatever Rocky and Christmas was doing. I think now you're looking at a much different offense, and I think you might have an expectation by, you know, the guards to maybe feed the post a little bit more than these guys are ready for. I think you might have a reliance on some of the returning shooters to say, oh, well, you know, we can utilize the paint a little bit more. I think that the paint's going to be not a weak spot, or at least hopefully not a weak spot, but, you know, it's not going to be the way we score points this year. And I think that's a big shift for a lot of these guys. And it, fairly or unfairly, puts a huge onus on, you know, Trevor Cooney and Malachi Richardson in particular to pick up the load a little bit while Benajay seems to be a jack of all trades and really doing a ton. I love what they're doing defensively. I think, you know, Lydon's really been impressive with steals, but I think you're looking at, you know, Benajay, Cooney, and Richardson just seem to be, you know, have a nose for the ball. Cooney in particular has really kind of ramped up his defense. Obviously, he's always been a big high-risk, high-reward guy, but I know this will come out in one of the roundtable questions we have coming the next couple days, but my one issue is that Benajay is being expected to do a hell of a lot this early, and it's only going to get worse as the game gets tougher. I hope that he has the wheels to keep this up, because if he falls off, if his shooting falls off, if he has an off night, I'm pretty worried already.
Yeah, I just think for Cooney, it's so much of his identity is as a shooter, and that just hasn't shown up this year, and he's never been consistent. It's almost unfortunate because he, like you said, he played really good defense. I think he had 6 steals last night. He's been doing quite well with the other facets of his game. He just is such a high-volume shooter and has never put together like a stretch like we saw from like Andy Routens, who was, by the end of his career, just a total knockdown guy. So it's unfortunate. Hopefully he does come with that, but luckily he's not the only shooter on this team this year. Richardson, I think, is fantastic. I'm excited to see him going forward. I think Lydon's a very interesting player, hopefully more at the 4 than the 5. But ultimately, I'm encouraged by what we've seen from Benajay and Richardson and a couple others. Benajay had like one of the quiet 23-point games I can remember. I assumed he was at like 18 before I looked at the box score. Another factor, which I said to some people last night, is this team going into the year was expecting to have Mustafa Jang on the roster, who would have been, I think, through 2 games, I think he would have been a very good player for this team, if only to provide depth at the center position, even if he's not like a true 5, he's more of a 4/5, but that's a pretty important body that this team thought it was getting until late in the summer. So that really hurt us, because obviously there was no time to go pick up someone to replace the minutes that we were expecting for him to lock.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up a great point. You know, I mean, and I said it earlier too, the minutes are insane. I mean, Benajay's playing already at this point. Usually you don't see this in a Boeheim team. Benajay's playing almost full games. You know, Cooney's playing almost full games. Richardson's already playing, you know, almost 33 points a game. Like, this reminds me a ton of the 07-08 squad already, and we really don't have the injuries to back that up. You know, Johnny Flynn was logging 38, 39 minutes a night. This seems a lot like that already, where we're going to need, you know, Richardson, Cooney, and Benajay in particular to log 35+. And I just, again, it's a team that's going to run out of gas. You brought up Cooney, too. I think he does so many things well away from shooting that he's really only out there as a decoy because he's still going to jack up the same amount of shots, whether he's a quote-unquote shooter or not. I mean, out of the 3 players that are taking the most shots, he has the lowest shooting percentage, at least from 3. He has the lowest shooting percentage of anyone not named Tyler Roberson that's regularly seeing the floor. I mean, that's not the guy that you need out there for 39 minutes, and that sucks. He's a senior. He should be a leader. And you know, I mean, whether he needs to be encouraged yet again to drive the lane or come inside the arc or do whatever he needs to do to get his head right. I mean, he's scoring 15.5 points a game. So this isn't to belabor the point, but it's to say that, you know, this is a guy who needs to get his head right and maybe redefine himself if 3-point specialist. And right now, based on the numbers, it isn't, you know, it isn't his calling anymore.
Yeah, and I would love to see him take the ball to the hoop more. Obviously, he's a very good free throw shooter. He's invaluable to have out there at the end of the game, and he's probably our most steady ball handler, to be honest. So I think he needs to be on the floor. I kind of agree. I'd like to see his 3-point volume go down, especially because we have guys. I mean, pretty much everyone else is at least a threat. So it's not like Cooney has to be out there, because otherwise we don't have anyone who can even think about knocking one down. I think the Caleb Joseph thing is kind of a mystery. I didn't see all the first game. I was out to dinner, so I didn't have a chance to watch the full game. But I thought he, from what I saw, looked like kind of a different player. Like he could be kind of an explosive guy off the bench potentially. And then last game he was a total non-factor. He only played, I don't even think he played in the second half. He only played 4 minutes against the Bonnies. After 14, where he scored 8 points against Lehigh. So his whole role, obviously, Boeheim, there's always mind games and stuff going on with him. He can be very short with certain guys and can give other guys as much rope as they need, Cooney especially. I think we're going to need Caleb to be a player this year. I don't think we can afford him to just be, you know, riding the bench and coming in for spot minutes here and there. I think he needs to be a factor.
Yeah, I mean, do you think the Caleb Joseph is your signature Jim Boeheim doghouse player of the year?
It certainly looks like it, like by all indications. I mean, Howard is a freshman. Freshmen only go so far, especially when they're not superstars. Aboko is the classic, you know, reserve big who is very limited. Coleman has his injury. You know, he's just obviously shaking off rust, but I think he would be out there more if we could afford it. I mean, the fact that Caleb only played 4 minutes last game, I know it was a close game, but it's kind of astounding, especially because he didn't play at all during the stretch run where we actually opened it up.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not like Joseph is a guy who played sparingly last year and then is kind of working his way in. I mean, this isn't like a Tyler Roberson a couple years ago situation or any of the other doghouse guys who eventually work themselves into really solid to great rotation players. I mean, this is a guy who Boeheim was talking up. It seemed like he was really getting better. You saw the tape, and Joseph really did seem to be getting better. He's put in great numbers. You know, he's not perfect, but, you know, in the limited time he's had out there, I mean, he's still scoring, you know, 4 points in, you know, 4 points per game on a, you know, 9 minute average. I mean, that's, to me, that's really productive. And he's also, the one thing he's doing really well that the other players, you know, Benajay, Cooney, and Richardson in particular aren't doing is he's really protecting the ball more. You know, he's only got one turnover in his time out there. And, you know, Benajay, Cooney, and Richardson right now, seven apiece. I mean, they're, overall, they're not really doing us any favors in the assist turnover ratio. I mean, they're not dishing the ball out all that often. And then they're also turning it over more. I mean, Benajay is the only one of those three that actually has more assists per game than turnovers per game, which is not a great stat, especially against the caliber of opponents we've faced. And it's definitely disconcerting. And that's, I think, another reason why, like, Joseph needs to be inserted, even if it's gradually more into this. Even if not a ball handler, as a sure shooter, I mean, you take away Cooney shot 17 threes already and only hit five. You take out 5 to 7 of those and throw them over to Joseph, who seems a little more shorthanded from three right now and through the offseason. And who knows? You know, maybe that gets the scoring spark that we need.
Yeah, and I do think that Lehigh and St. Bonaventure, obviously they're not big games, but I think those are both probably better than your average low major team that we see this early. I don't know much about Charlotte and Elon. It looks like Elon beat Charlotte pretty handily in their season opener. So maybe these two teams will be a little bit easier to deal with, but I do think Lehigh and St. Bonnie's were probably a bit of a step up from what we're used to in terms of like the early season fodder that we play. And overall, this schedule is definitely something that's a bit more challenging with the tournament in the Bahamas and then Wisconsin and Georgetown back-to-back. And then, you know, St. John's looked pretty awful, but they're still a name. Cornell's often pretty decent. So I think the normal monotony of, like, really easy games is broken up pretty well this year. But hopefully we'll get back to, like, just beating teams pretty handily and can get guys like Joseph and Howard and Aboko more run and hopefully expand this this rotation a bit more, because usually you don't want to have your guys playing, you know, have five guys playing 25 plus minutes each. It just isn't healthy this early in the year when you're going to need those guys all for the stretch run. Otherwise, the season's going to be a very long and ugly one.
Agreed. What's the, I know we're kind of wrapping up. What's the one storyline that you hope you and I are kind of going back and forth on with this basketball team next week when we chat?
Ooh, next week. So how much do we have? What do we have before then? I guess we will not have played in the Bahamas yet, or we will have just started. I kind of hope it is some of these bench guys kind of finding a role. I just don't think we can afford to have a seven or even like a what right now looks like a six and a half man rotation. I think we really need seven or eight guys who can all go out there and play minutes. So hopefully Joseph works through whatever is keeping him in the doghouse and Coleman continues to develop. If we get like one really nice name in a Coleman, I think that'll do a lot to assuage the fears of the fan base.
Agreed. I think, you know what, and I'm fine with him being slow to develop this year, but I do think that that requires a little bit more out of Lydon and Roberson in particular. Obviously, Roberson does his usual crashing the boards. He's done a great job, especially, you know, on the offensive glass. But what I think we need to see from him is some sort of offensive prowess. It's been a struggle in the past. I know it was. We always laugh at that one quote about him as a jump shooter from one of his previous coaches. But you don't have to be a jump shooter to put up more than 3 points per game, especially when you're out on the floor for 25 minutes. I think if Roberson can give us eight a night, I think that right away changes the tenor of how this team plays in the paint. And I'm curious to see, you know, how his game changes and how quickly he could potentially be back in the Boeheim doghouse, you know, if he doesn't start scoring.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like things are open for him because there are so many shooters. The floor should be spaced pretty well where he can operate from 8-10 feet out. And we saw him last year. His two best games of the season were against Duke. Like, this guy is not overmatched talent-wise. He's played against some of the best guys in the country. He was fantastic in those two Duke games and a couple other games down the stretch last year. So, and there's never room for two people in the Boeheim doghouse. The Boeheim doghouse is one vacancy. Joseph, I think, is pretty solidly there. There's not room for Roberson to be in there as well. So he needs to, we need him to find his niche and find a way to add something to the offense. Like you said, it doesn't need to be 14 points a game. Eight, great. If he's giving us eight and eight a night, and there are nights where he goes off and is doing like 15 and 12, that's great. But it needs to be something. It can't be like one basket in two games or whatever it is right now.
Agreed. And that's a good place for us to wrap up. I'm assuming you have us beating Elon by upwards of 10 points this weekend.
I know nothing about Elon. I hope that we're winning by, you know, 15. I would be okay with either, with anywhere in that range.
Fair enough. All right. And on that note, Dan, thanks a lot for joining, as always.
Yes. Hope everyone has a happy one of the last couple football weekends here. And obviously, we're getting in the swing of things with basketball. And obviously, we'll talk to everyone before Thanksgiving. So, no happy holidays yet, but it's coming up. So, hope everyone's excited.
Yep. I will be on East Coast time next week. So, Dan and I will be chatting on Tuesday. So, everyone will get to listen to that a little early before your Thanksgiving holiday. Perhaps you'll download it as a podcast for your trip to wherever you're going. In the meantime, be sure to rate, review, subscribe to us on Blog Talk, on iTunes, whatever other service you use for your podcasts. And go Orange.
Orange.